Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. During the 2008 presidential campaign, Barack Obama ran on the platform of change we can believe in. In this most recent campaign, the word was forward. But he has a different approach to the Supreme Court's interpretation of constitutional law. In his new book, The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court, Jeffrey Toobin describes how the Supreme Court's 2010 Citizens United decision and the Affordable Care Act ruling from 2012 show how the Constitution is being reinterpreted and how the Supreme Court precedent is quickly overturned. Jeffrey Toobin is CNN's senior legal analyst and a staff writer for The New Yorker. He joins us for this off-the-shelf edition of The Book Show, recorded live before a live audience in Manchester Center, Vermont. Please welcome Jeffrey Toobin.
How are you?
I am great.
Are you?
Seriously, I'm great.
I mean, there has to be sort of, I think we can all say this, but there's a collective sigh that the election's over, isn't there? I mean, don't you feel that?
Well, I mean, look, if you voted for the winner, it's great. But, I mean, I actually don't think election, you know, people always say, oh, they're so terrible and the commercials are so awful. I like them. I don't have a problem with that. I mean, I'm glad they end at some point, but I'm not, I don't feel like, oh, gosh, it's so good that it's over.
When you look at the story that you tell in The Oath, is there anything here that is changed in any way by what happened in the election?
Oh, a lot. Yeah. When you want to know about the Supreme Court, when you want to know about its past, you want to know about its future, the only question that matters is who's the winner of presidential elections. You know, you can talk about individual justices. One of the great myths about the Supreme Court is that presidents get surprised by their Supreme Court nominees. And that is largely due to the Eisenhower administration, where President Eisenhower was indeed surprised by Earl Warren and William Brennan. But you know what the Eisenhower administration was? A long time ago. And since then, and if you look at all nine justices on the current Supreme Court, they are pretty much as you would have expected the day they were confirmed. And they are, almost without exception, very true to the political inclinations of the president who supported them. So the fact that Barack Obama won this election tells you a good deal about where the Supreme Court is going, at least in the near term.
When you wanted to tell the story, you center around two major cases, of course, Citizens United and the Affordable Health Care Act. What is it about those particular cases that not only are historic, but tell us a very stark story of this Supreme Court and the relationship between the president and the Chief Justice,
right,
John Roberts?
Well, I think it's useful to think in some respects about the Supreme Court by the numbers. And there are six men and three women. There are six Catholics and three Jews. There are no Protestants. There are representatives of four New York City boroughs on the Supreme Court. You have Sonia Sotomayor from the Bronx, Antonin Scalia from Queens, Ruth Ginsburg from Brooklyn, and Elena Kagan from Manhattan. Tragically, Staten Island is unrepresented on the Supreme Court. But the most important number about the Supreme Court is that there are five Republicans and four Democrats. And if you look at those two cases, Citizens United and the healthcare case, and if you look at the third case, which I think belongs in a trilogy with those three, which is Bush v. Gore, you look at cases that are the political soul of the court laid bare. The fact that the court split along ideological lines in the first two of those cases, Bush v. Gore and Citizens United, and then through a very surprising, at least to me, series of circumstances, you had Chief Justice Roberts siding with the liberals in the Affordable Care Act. I mean, this to me illustrates just how political the court is.
Let's talk about that political nature, and specifically with health care reform and the Affordable Care Act. When the vote was being, when it was being read, and the decision was being read, Initially, did you think that, oh, okay, they're going to strike this down? Because then it took a very quick turn.
I've been privileged to watch history unfold as a journalist. It's one of the great privileges of being a journalist. But I don't think I have ever felt watching an event that history was unfolding before my eyes like I did last June 25th at 10 in the morning. Because when the justices came out from behind that red curtain, there was only one case left. Everybody knew what was coming. Everybody knew the stakes. I mean, 35 million people were either going to get health insurance or they weren't going to get health insurance based on what was going to happen from behind that curtain. And they walked out. Only those of us in the room could hear what was going on because they don't even do radio, much less TV, out of this Supreme Court. So it was just, and the Supreme Court, I'm sure if any of you have been there, it's not even that big a courtroom. I mean, it's bigger than most, but, you know, maybe if you count everybody in the room, maybe there are 500 people in the room. Chief Justice Roberts came out, and as we all knew, he was deciding the case. And the first issue he discussed was the issue of the Commerce Clause, which was the main issue in the oral argument, which was, does the Commerce Clause of Article I allow Congress to pass an individual mandate, the requirement that individuals buy health insurance? And I heard him talking, describing his opinion, and I was sitting next to Dahlia Lithwick, the wonderful correspondent from Slate magazine, and I remember turning to her and I said, wow, he really is killing it. He's killing it. He's killing the law. And catty-cornered to me in the spectator benches, the press benches are perpendicular to the bench, but the spectator benches are parallel. And I happened to see Orrin Hatch, the senator, who was there, and, you know, very conservative senator from Utah. And I saw him beaming as Roberts was reading the part of his opinion about the Commerce Clause. But then he said, but the government offers an alternative justification for the law. This was such a minor part of the oral argument that I didn't even know he would deal with it in the summary of his opinion he read from the bench. And he started talking about Congress's power under the taxing power. And in short order, it became clear that he was upholding the law. And I saw Orrin Hatch's face fall. I mean, it was almost comic. It was like, you know, just, you know, in a cartoon figure going, whoa. I mean, and I remember seeing, in retrospect, Justice Scalia looking so bereft. And I wondered, what's he so unhappy about? He's winning the case. But then I realized that he was, in fact, losing the case. It was very surprising.
Give us a sense of how that decision came about for Roberts, because you do say in the book that ultimately this could help the right in the future because of that trilogy that you mentioned.
Yes, fortunately I'm not a politician, so I don't have to worry about flip-flopping. I flip-flop all the time, and I actually don't think this is going to help the right very much, even in the long run. So why did John Roberts switch? Why did he vote with the liberals? Well, I think for starters, you have to take what he wrote at face value. He simply thought it was a justifiable use of the taxing power. I think it's more complicated than that, though. I think Roberts sees himself correctly as the custodian of the court's public reputation. He sees himself as someone who has to be responsible for how the court is perceived. And he knew that the public saw this as the next chapter after Bush v. Gore and Citizens United. And if the court, again, split 5-4 in a highly partisan way with the five conservatives trashing the dreams of Democrats yet again, that the court would suffer in public esteem. And this being an election year, the court would have become a big issue in the presidential campaign. Plus, Roberts knew, as anyone who followed this issue knew, that the individual mandate, the requirement that people buy health insurance, was a conservative idea. This came from the Heritage Foundation. This was supported by Republicans through the 90s and into the last decade. It was supported by such figures as Newt Gingrich and a former Massachusetts governor named Mitt Romney, who you may remember. And for 20-plus years, this idea had been in circulation, and not one person had ever suggested that it was unconstitutional. Is that because no one noticed? I mean, it was just a bad argument that it was unconstitutional. And if the court had embraced it, 5-4, it would really have damaged the court's reputation. And I think Roberts had the foresight and the integrity to say, you know what, we're not going to go this far. I assure you, he did not discover his inner moderate last June. He is going to be the conservative he's been, but for this case, he wasn't willing to go that far.
Jeffrey Toobin is our guest on The Book Show. The name of the new book, The Oath, The Obama White House, and the Supreme Court. And it's for those reasons, more than just a message, he could have voted differently in Citizens United. The fact that that was sent back and asked to be broadened, there is a case to be made that if he wanted to make his case for the court and not being a partisan court, he could have made it then as well.
He could have made it then as well. But look, I mean, but this is my point. Do not be misled about who John Roberts is and what he believes. He is a deeply conservative man. And, you know, it is no coincidence that George W. Bush, a very conservative president, put him on the Supreme Court. Now, he is going to vote and has voted for the conservative side in the overwhelming majority of cases. So, you know, you can pick any case and say, well, he could have voted with the liberals. He's not with them. I mean, he's not on their side. So the fact that he was part of the coalition that revolutionized campaign finance law in Citizens United, that's John Roberts. So, you know, yes, he could have been more moderate, but he's not a moderate. So
tell us a little bit about that case, because initially it was a very narrow and somewhat minor case that then becomes a huge case.
Well, you know, the great thing about Citizens United, at least from a journalistic point of view, is that, you know, so many storylines in the history of the court intersect at Citizens United. It was the first case ever argued in any courtroom by Elena Kagan, who was then the Solicitor General. It was the first case ever heard by the new Justice Sonia Sotomayor. It was the last dissenting opinion written by John Paul Stevens. And it was the first case that was re-argued, that is, argued a second time, by in well more than a decade. And it was... And the driving force behind the behind-the-scenes struggle in the Supreme Court was your neighbor across the river, David Souter of New Hampshire, who really wanted to blow the whistle when it was argued the first time and the court tried to go way farther than the facts justified. Now, as my father used to say, to make a long story unbearable, the case involved a documentary produced by this sort of wacky conservatives organization, Citizens United. It's called Hillary the Movie, and it was all spooky music, and she's so terrible and whatnot. And it was meant to be part of the 2008 campaign. And the Federal Election Commission ruled that it was a commercial, so it couldn't be shown within 30 days of the primaries. They challenged that through the courts. The first time it was argued, the question of whether this eccentric movie by a nonprofit organization called Citizens United could be shown within 30 days of an election, it could have been decided in a very narrow way. But what happened behind the scenes is that the conservatives decided to use it as a vehicle to rewrite 100 years of election law. And Souter said, this is outrageous, and John Roberts, crafty strategist that he is, sort of topped him and said, well, okay, you think this is so outrageous, we'll just re-argue the case with the broader question in front of everyone. So you can't accuse us of sandbagging you anymore. And what could Souter and the liberals do at that point? But they accepted the re-argument. But that re-argument essentially was kind of a kabuki theater because those justices had already really voted on the case and they knew how it was going to come out.
How is it not evil?
Evil. I'm a little uncomfortable with that. Look, there are two metaphors at the heart of Citizens United. One of them gets a lot of attention, one of them doesn't. The one that gets a lot of attention is the idea that corporations are people.
That's the evil part.
I don't think it's so evil.
Really?
Actually. No. Because I work for CNN. I work for The New Yorker. My book is published by Doubleday. All of them corporations. All of them very happy to wrap themselves in the First Amendment. I mean, corporations have First Amendment rights. That has been true for decades. And I wouldn't want to live in a society otherwise. Now, what has also been true is that the Supreme Court has said, yes, corporations have First Amendment rights, but they can be regulated because of the risks to society of giving corporations too much power. So anyway, I don't have like a big problem with the corporations as people metaphor. The other metaphor is more important and more troubling. That is, money is speech.
Right.
That spending money, giving money to a political campaign or a support of a political cause is as much an expression of First Amendment rights as carrying a picket sign or giving a speech on a street corner. That is a troubling metaphor because that really undermines the whole artifice of campaign finance reform, of any limits on corporations, individuals, Sheldon Adelson, anyone else who wants to give millions of dollars in support of a political candidate. And that is the metaphor that is much more, I think, damaging to how we do politics in this country than corporations or people.
So how did we see it play out in this election cycle?
Well, you know, it sort of reminds me of the famous old New Yorker cartoon of, you know, a couple is sitting there on a park bench. It's like in multiple panels, and you know, a bad guy comes along and snatches a woman's purse, and he, as he's running away, he slips on a banana peel and he falls down, and the cops catch him, and the guy says, "See, I told you the system works." It is true that Karl Rove and company and the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson spent a boatload of money. You know, I don't think we have the full tally. I mean, certainly close to $500 million is a reasonable estimate. And Barack Obama kicked their ass, right? So obviously the money didn't matter. Well, no, I don't think it works that way. Money still matters a great deal. And yes, because of a weird confluence of circumstances, you know, Obama won despite this. And don't kid yourself, Barack Obama raised a great deal of money himself, you know, not in the same way, but he certainly was not defenseless against this onslaught. But when you look at the implications, you know, presidential elections are sort of aberrational when it comes to money in politics because they get so much attention from the news media that the political commercials and whatnot mean less. But when you talk about down-ballot elections and judicial elections, which are so important, which don't get nearly the attention they deserve, I mean, it's not in a state like this where you don't have them, but you know, in states where you know you have these very competitive Supreme Court races, you know, to have unlimited expenditures from shadowy groups, it matters enormously, and will only matter more in future elections.
So what do we take from this election? You talk in the book about President Obama's two Supreme Court nominations, and obviously very telling. But you also make the point about his lower court picks. That is a little more of a, it seems to be a strange picture.
It's a paradox. One of the great mysteries of the Obama presidency is why he has not put more emphasis on lower courts and, you know, district court and circuit court nominations. He hasn't filled all the vacancies that are there. He hasn't spoken out on this issue really at all. And this is obviously not because of ignorance. I mean, Barack Obama was president of the Harvard Law Review. He was taught at a very distinguished law school, the University of Chicago. This is not a man who is unaware of the importance of the law. You know, he wrote something in The Audacity of Hope, his second book, where he said, you know, liberals spent too much time focusing on the courts and not enough on elections. And he may have a point in that. But that is not an excuse to neglect one of the great levers of power that a president has. And I know his Obama's lassitude has been a source of great frustration to the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, you know, Vermont's own Patrick Leahy.
What changes do you sense in the coming 4 years, then?
You know, not much. I mean, I think people are who they are. And I think, you know, I think Obama will probably try to pick up the pace somewhat. But, I mean, this is just not something that motivates him a great deal. And I remain surprised by it. I have asked people in the White House even since the election. So, is this going to be a big change the next term? And they go, I don't know, maybe. I don't see it. And it is... I need to add that one reason Obama, but only one reason why Obama has not been able to put a stamp on the lower courts like he might have, is the incredibly determined, focused opposition of Senate Republicans and the obstruction of his judicial nominees. But you know what? That's not the only reason. And Republicans do this because they understand the stakes. He's the president. He's got more senators than they have. He's got more power than they have. So it's not like he just has to sit there and take it. And by and large, that's what he's done. Now, maybe it'll change, but I haven't seen any indications that it will.
If we have this discussion in 4 years, and hopefully there'll be a new book out. At what?
I hope so.
Yeah, I hope so.
God, they're so hard to write. I just, the thought of doing, I mean, I've written six, but it just... It's like I like having written books, but you know, anyway, yes,
can we speculate a bit about the face of the Supreme Court at the end of the Obama administration?
With the Supreme Court, what is a social pleasantry in other circumstances is a real question when you're talking to a Supreme Court justice, and that question is, how are you? It's like, no, I really want to know. How are you? And can I see the blood work too? Okay. So you never know for sure. But there are four justices in their 70s. Ruth Ginsburg is 79. Justice Scalia and Justice Kennedy are 76. Stephen Breyer is 74. Ruth Ginsburg has said that she wants to serve as long as Louis Brandeis, who was 82 when he left the court, which would mean she'd leave somewhere in the middle of the next administration. If Romney had won the election, I think Ginsburg would have said, well, 84 is actually better. I mean, these justices are very aware of who the president is when they're leaving. I mean, they take it very seriously. Ruth Ginsburg will leave in the next 4 years. Scalia and Kennedy will not if they can help it. I mean, Scalia has, I mean, you know, I give him points for candor. He says, well, you know, I would leave and have someone appointed who would try to undo my life's work. Why would I do that? And he's right. I mean, you know, and Rehnquist was similar. I mean, Rehnquist made, you know, he's just like, we pay attention to these things. You know, we don't want our life's work undone. So, you know, I think Obama will certainly get one appointment, but my guess is that's all he'll get.
The name of the new book is The Oath, The Obama White House and the Supreme Court. It is published by Doubleday. Jeffrey Toobin, it's been a great pleasure to have you join us on this live edition of The Book Show.
Thanks, Joe.
Jeffrey Toobin's new book is The Oath. It is published by Doubleday. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org. And you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. This has been an off-the-shelf edition of The Book Show in partnership with the Northshire Bookstore in Manchester Center, Vermont, northshire.com. Sarah LaDuke produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.